I'm pulling on my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for another drive to work. Okay, so last we left, we were in the middle of Urza's Saga. I think I got through H. So we are up to K. Because I have no I's or J's. Karn, Silver Golem. So he's an artifact creature, a legendary creature, legendary artifact creature, and he's a golem. He costs 5 mana. He's a 4/4 creature. If he blocks or is blocked, he gets -4/+4. So he turns from a 4/4 into a 0/8. And he has the ability to spend 1 mana, target creature, or target non-creature artifact, becomes an XX artifact creature, where X is the converted mana cost of the artifact. Okay, so so Karn is a character in the Wesolite Saga. So, originally, Karn was the protector for, in the original version of the story, Gerard was sent away, and Karn was his protector. We later learned that Karn had a role in the legacy. In fact, Karn was part of the legacy. But anyway, when they rewrote the story, they decided they wanted to bring Urza in. And so they decided that Karn, because we hadn't defined who made Karn when we did the original version of the story. So it was decided that Urza made Karn. Urza was doing temporal experiments. And the one substance capable of traveling through time unaffected, supposedly, was silver. So he made a golem out of silver. That's the story. In the Wesolite Saga, in the first part of the story, he was what we call the gentle giant archetype, which was he was really strong, but he was a pacifist. So what had happened was he had accidentally killed somebody with his strength, and so he vowed never to harm anyone again. That's where we picked up in the story. That was where Karn started. And so we wanted to represent, well, we want him to be big and strong, but we didn't want him to harm anybody. I'm like, okay, how do you do that? So we said, okay, he's a 4/4, but in combat, he's a 0/8. So the idea is, it's really, really hard for someone to kill him, but he's not going to kill anybody else. You know, he took a vow against killing anybody else, so he's not going to kill any other creatures. That's what the -4/+4 thing is all about. The other ability is, actually, interesting story. So we made a set called Vanguard, which was a series of cards that let you get to start the game with a variant hand size and life total, and then you get an ability. If the ability is really good, maybe your hand size or your life total is lower than normal. If it's a little weaker, maybe it's above normal. And so what happened was, we had made the Vanguard cards flavor agnostic, because we didn't know how we were going to flavor them. And then when it became clear that we were doing the Wesolite Saga, we decided to take the cards and do characters from the Wesolite Saga. Well, one of the characters from the Wesolite Saga was Karn. So we looked at all the cards we had, and we decided that one of them was, basically, it animated all the artifacts. It was Titania Song from, is that Antiquities? So the Titania Song was a green enchantment that just animated all non-creature artifacts equal to the converted mana cost, minimum XX creatures. So we decided that we would have that be an ability. And when we were looking through the characters, we're like, well, Karn's an artifact. I guess it makes more sense that of anybody to care about artifacts, let's have Karn care about artifacts. So when we went to go design this character, this was a year later, like the Karn card had come out, and people kind of associated Karn with animating things, even though in the story, I mean, there was a bond between Karn and the legacy. He was part of a legacy. So he had a bond with artifacts, but he didn't really animate them in the story. But people really liked that association. So we said, okay, I guess that's what he does. And so because of the popularity of the Vanguard card, we made his magic card do something very similar. Instead of just being a flat turns everything on, you have to activate it to turn things on. But it also allows you to turn any artifact, a non-creature artifact, into a creature. So you could also use it as a way to turn your opponent's thing into a creature so you can kill it with a creature kill spell, for example. The Vanguard card only turns your things on, for example. But anyway, that was Karn. So one of the things we had looked for during Urza's Saga block was who are characters that are old enough that we could make them in the past. And so, for example, Karn, of the Weatherlight crew, for example, Karn was the only one really old enough that it made sense that we, you know, Karn could be very, very old. He's an artifact creature. And there's other characters that you would later see. Multani, obviously, was very old. Rafelos, who's an elf, so he can be relatively old. We definitely showed you some other characters that were actually part of the Wesolite Saga, but were from farther back, or were part of the backstory in some cases of the Wesolite Saga. Like, Gerard studied under Multani, The reason Gerardo left the Weatherlight was the death of Rofellos, which was his friend. He had studied with Rofellos and Miri under Multani. Anyway, but one of these days I'll do the Weatherlight saga. But that is not today. Okay, next we have Launch. So Launch is an enchantment, an aura. Costs one and a blue, so two mana, one of which is blue. Enchanted creature gains flying. But, this is the interesting part of it, if Launch is put into the graveyard, I think from anywhere, you return it to your hand. So the idea essentially is, if I put this on my creature and then the creature dies, or if my opponent naturalizes my enchantment, you know, if they get rid of the enchantment or get rid of the creature, I get it back. So this was the enchantment block. We were trying to make enchantments more useful. So we made a cycle of auras that you got back. So the idea was, well, you're not going to have card advantage with these. If the creature dies, you get it back. If they destroy it, you get it back. You get it back. So you can use it again and again. And the effects didn't have to be particularly strong. Like a flight, you know, an aura that grants flying, in a vacuum, is not particularly strong. It's only strong in the sense that, you know, if they just destroy the creature that's capable of flying, well, then you can make another creature fly. So that makes it a bit stronger. The most powerful of these enchantments actually wouldn't end up in Urza's Saga, but in Urza's Legacy. So when we get to Urza's Legacy, I will talk about it. Okay, next, Lightning Dragon. Two red for a dragon. So four mana, two which is red. It has Flying and Echo, and it has Fire Breathing. Spend a red mana, get +1/+0 to end of turn. This was, I believe, the pre-release card. If you went to the Urza's Saga pre-release, this was the pre-release card you would get. We'd started doing pre-release cards the year before in Tempest, I believe. Tempest was the first set to have a pre-release card. And so Lightning Dragon was the pre-release card for this set. It's another example of a pretty good Echo creature. You know, four mana for a... how big was it? I didn't write down how big it was. I think it was 5/5. It's either 4/4 or 5/5. But the idea that you got a dragon with fire breathing out of the gate... the fire breathing was kind of cutesy because the first turn you obviously were paying mana for the echo, so you probably weren't paying too much of the fire breathing. I mean, maybe late game you're paying more, but normally, let's say I played on turn 4, then on turn 5, assuming I have a land, I can fire breathe it once, so I can make it, you know, let's say it's a 4/4, and I can do 5 damage with it. And then the turn after that, I could do a whole bunch of damage with it once the echo's all paid off, so. But anyway, just a good example of an Echo creature that was actually pretty powerful. Okay, next, Lurking Evil, black enchantment. You can pay half your life, round it up, and if you do, this becomes a 4/4 flying whore. Okay, so there were all the colors but red has sleeping enchantments, and each one of them cared about conditions. The black ones, which were the lurking enchantments, usually made you do something negative to yourself in order to... activated. It wasn't that your opponent had to do something, you had to do something. That's how the black ones were different. Most of the other ones, I think the white, blue, and green ones were all your opponent needed to do something, which turned this into a creature. And black was the only one that sort of, it was in your hand. Usually it had to be painful, you did something bad to yourself. But Lurking Evil is a good example where it's essentially black, you know, pay half your life, you get a 4/4 flying creature. Now, maybe early game, maybe, you know, this card's interesting in that it gets a little bit better as you go down in life just because the amount of life you're losing is less. Although, obviously, you're always getting closer to being dead. But, anyway. Next, the Metronome. It's an artifact. Costs 4. If a spell or ability controlled by an opponent makes you discard it, you get 4/1/1 gnome tokens. So, one of the things we like to do is have anti-discard strategies. And one of the popular ones back in the day was... Okay, this is your hand, and your opponent makes you discard it, something positive happens for you. I think back in Alpha, there was the blue card that would do damage to your opponent if you had to discard it, and then in Alliances, there was a red card that did damage if your opponent made you discard it. This one made creatures. So if you discard it, it did that. You also could spend 4 mana and tap to make a 1/1 gnome. And they were artifact creatures. Make a 1/1 artifact creature. So the idea was this is a little gnome maker, but it had a built-in anti-discard strategy. So this card didn't get played a lot. It got played a little bit as a sideboard anti-discard strategy. Metronome, I think I actually named this card. Back in the day, my friends and I used to play Dungeons & Dragons, and my friend Andy had a gnome he played named Umlaut, I believe was his name. And anyway, in the game, he was from the city, and so we dubbed him Umlaut, the Metronome, and I just liked the name Metronome. So I think I named this, and the creative team thought it was a funny name. They kept it, is my memory of this. The way it used to work is when we used to do names is some of our names would be silly and we had no intention of them ever actually being real names. But every once in a while we'd take a shot at what we considered to be a real name. I don't know whether this was me trying to make a real name or me goofing around and do something silly and they liked it. But anyway, the Metronome. Okay, next is Morphling. 3 blue, so 5 mana, 2 which is blue, for a 3/3 shapeshifter. And it has 5 abilities. You heard me right. 5 abilities. For a blue mana, you can untap it. Also for a blue mana, you can grant flying till end of turn. Also for a blue mana, you can grant shroud till end of turn, so it can't be the target of spells or abilities. Note that shroud did not exist as a keyword yet. It was spelled out. Or you can spend 1 to make it +1/-1 until end of turn. Or you can spend 1 to make it -1/+1 till end of turn. So the idea here is, so look, this has an interesting story. So basically what happened was, we wanted to make Clone. Clone was an uncommon card in Alpha. It was very popular with the players, but it had a lot of rules problems because just copying things is complicated. So for a while, the rules didn't really know how to handle Clone. But we thought it was time for Clone to return. So we put Clone in the set. I think we put it at Rare, though. And we put it in the set. And then at the last minute, like art had been commissioned and everything, at the last minute, the rules people said, yeah, we can't make this work. This can't be Clone. But the problem was we'd already made the art. And the art was, traditional Clone art, which is 2 creatures that look just like each other, except one is just a little bit different. If you look, you'll see it's a little bit different. One of the Morphlings has a little tail, you'll see. But anyway, so we're like, oh, well, we have art for, we have art that is sort of what we normally would use for a clone. I mean, it is very much like, get it? I'm copying it. So we're like, okay, well, we're kind of committed to a shapeshifter. Like, the art says it's a shapeshifter. There's no way around that. So the idea was, okay, what can we do? You know, we need to make a card from scratch that could be a shapeshifter. So we came up with the idea of, what if we made something that just gave you a lot of options for how it could change? So we first came up with the idea of, well, we'll do +1/-1 or -1/+1. So it's a 3/3 creature, but you can change around its stats. And the reason we did -1/+1 is, okay, it's got 6 power, you know, we call it girth in R&D, meaning power and toughness combined. That's a nickname. It's got a girth of 6. So it means you can have anything from a 5/1, because it has to have at least 1 toughness, to a 0/6. You know, assuming you have the mana. Then we said, well, what else can we do to it? And we liked the idea of, okay, well, flying, that's a pretty blue thing. Blue at the time was kind of limited on keywords, so we did untap. That's something you can do in blue. And there are things like Hermetic Study. Like, I talked about Hermetic Study and Hermit Crab were a good combo. Well, Hermetic Study was also a wonderful combo with Morphling. Not that there weren't other things to do with Morphling, but it was a great combo with Morphling. And finally, we decided to do something that was kind of counterspell-ish. Sort of like, okay, I can't be the target of spell's abilities, which essentially was a way to counter things that targeted it. Okay, I'm going to destroy it. Oh, now, you can't target it now and it fizzles. Morphling went on to be insanely popular. It's very funny, like, we tried to do one thing, had a scramble the last minute, and it became quite popular. So popular, in fact, that we've started, over time, we have made other color versions of this. We made a green version and a red version, and people keep asking us to finish the cycle. But it is kind of cool. It became a very iconic magic creature. It is very funny for like how last minute this creature was put together and then it went on to be something so iconic. It's a very powerful card. It was particularly powerful, especially when you had damage on the stack, that you could sort of do damage and then change its stats so it would survive. So it both did its damage and survived the damage. That's no longer true. I mean, not that it's a weak card or anything, but that did make it a little bit stronger. Okay, Persecute, 2 black sorcery. Choose a color, and then you look at target player's hand, and you make him discard all cards of that color. So one of the things, I made this card just because I like having little mini games, and I like the idea of, it's a discard card, but I kind of got to figure out, like, what I think is, the threat in your hand. Now, obviously, with monocolor decks, you know, it's good side running. It's monocolor decks. They're all that color. I mean, it's designed not to hit land, because land isn't colored. But when they're playing against two-color decks, or more than two-color decks, you start getting interesting choices. Like, okay, they're playing red and green. Am I more afraid of red things or more afraid of green things? What do I think they might have in their hand? Anyway, it's a pretty cool card. It's powerful, but it's pretty cool. Okay, Pestilence. Pestilence is two black enchantment. At the end of the turn, if there are no creatures on the battlefield, sacrifice it. And then for one black, you can deal one damage to each creature and player. So Pestilence goes all the way back to Alpha. It's a fun card. It's a very flavorful card. A few issues with it. One is it's not supposed to be common. This card this card is one of the major things. Urza Saga Limited was really, really warped. If you went to the Pro Tour, for example, and watched people drafting, like 3, 4, sometimes 5 people would get into black in Urza Saga. 5 people? So black was really powerful and really deep in common. Pestilence being the biggest part of it. I mean, Pestilence wipes boards. Like, it's just not, under nothing about it should it be common. It is a super uber powerful card. And as a little rider, like, it goes away if there's no creatures get it, because it's Pestilence, and if there's nobody to carry the disease, it goes away. But in Limited, it's not hard to keep something around. You control sort of how much Pestilence you do. And it is a brutal, brutal card in Limited. So the fact that this was common is nutty. I mean, getting one Pestilence out will win you the game, but having multiple in your deck so you can get guaranteed to draw one is anyway. That said, the other problem with it is, really, the flavor is super black. I mean, I guess one could argue it's black just because the flavor is so black. The abilities, what's funny, in Planar Chaos, we did it in red. What do we call it? Pyrohemia, I think? But anyway, the doing damage to everything, black doesn't really do damage to things. Black can make players lose life. It can give -1/-1 to creatures. You could clearly argue that, look, it can kill creatures, look, it can damage players. You know, this is just it doing it in a way that's simple. This is the kind of card that we don't really do much in black anymore. Black used to do this. This is the kind of thing that every once in a while we do in black, and we really have not done black. It's more of a red thing now than a black thing. I will say, in a vacuum, this card is a beauty. This card is a thing of beauty from a design flavor standpoint. It's super flavorful, and it's potent. Probably a little too powerful, but it is a very cool, flavorful, you know, neatly designed card. I give it big props to Richard for making it. It's a really cool card. I give slops to us for putting it in common in Urza Saga. That was a big mistake. But anyway, Pestilence. Okay, moving on is Phyrexian Processor. Okay, so here's another story of a card we tried to make that got changed at the last minute after art was done. I think it was after art was done. Okay, so if you guys have ever played Mirrodin, there's a card called Soul Foundry, where you exile a creature card from your hand, and you imprint it, and then that artifact makes token copies of that card. It was called Clone Machine in design. Anyway, Clone Machine was this card. Phyrexian Processor was Clone Machine, was Soul Foundry. And the rules people came to me. You see a theme here. The rules people were very naysayer back in the day, and said to me, yeah, you can't do that. It doesn't work. And they wouldn't let me do it. And I tried and I tried. I really thought that Clone Machine was an awesome... I still think Clone Machine is an awesome card. Soul Foundry is an awesome card. But anyway, I couldn't convince them to do that, so we had to change it again. But the art had come in, and it showed a creature being made. In fact, I think it was one of those things where I think you see a creature and then another copy of the creature is being made, kind of hinting that it's making multiple of the same creature. So we said, okay, we have to make something that makes creatures and can make multiples of the same creature. So we came up with the Phyrexian Processor. What does it do? It's an artifact that costs 4. When it enters the battlefield, you choose some amount of life, and then 4 and tap, make XX minion, black minion creature tokens, where X is the life paid when you played it. So if I pay 10 life, it can make 10 tens. If I pay 19 life, it can make 19 19s. If I pay 5 life, it can make 5 fives. It's sort of, how much do I want to risk? So for those that have never watched, if you ever want to go online and watch a really good match, John Finkel against Bob Maher, two future Hall of Famers, are playing in the finals of the World Championship 2000 in Brussels, Belgium. And they are playing the same deck, Both decks have Fretch and Processor in it. It is one of the most dynamic, exciting matches. It's a really cool match. I think it went to 5 games. And the Phyrexian Processor, in fact, the reason John Finkel won that and became world champion is because Bob Marr made a subtle error with how much life to use for his Phyrexian Processor. Now, to be clear, it wasn't like everybody was aware he made a mistake. It's like, after analyzing everything with days to think about it, we realized that he'd made a mistake. I'm sure John realized he made a mistake the second he did it. But Bob had made a slight mistake that John capitalized on and won. But anyway, it was a really good game. There were giant creatures, 10-10s, 19-19s, giant creatures swinging back and forth. It was pretty cool. So, seriously, if you've never checked out it, it's a very neat match. And I'm pretty sure it is online. Okay, next, Pouncing Jaguar. It's a 2-2 for a single green mana with Echo. That's a simple Echo. Just a 2-power single for 1 mana, 1 mana 2-2. I know for a while there's a deck called Stompy, which was a really good mono-green weenie deck. I think they played Pouncing Jaguars. I know they played Wild Dogs, which we'll get to eventually. But anyway, I'm not sure whether they played Pouncing Jaguar or not. Some versions of Stompy might have played Pouncing Jaguar. Okay, next, Priest of Gix. 2 and a black for a 2-1. At the time it was a minion, now it's a human cleric minion. And when it enters the battlefield, it adds black, black, black. So this is kind of a free spell, but not exactly the free mechanic. The free mechanic is, when it enters the battlefield, untap the number of lands equal to what you would have paid to cast it, essentially. This just gives you the mana. So this kind of is an ETP Dark Ritual, essentially. But what makes it interesting is, it costs 3 mana. So essentially, if you have 3 mana, you get 3 mana back. He even converts it to black. I mean, if you have non-black mana, for good or for bad, he converts it to black. But anyway, he definitely is... this is a very powerful card. Saw a bunch of tournament play. Just because a 2-1 creature that essentially doesn't cost you mana. And more so than that, there are effects and stuff where you could replay him and things where you could... There's ways to sort of gain mana off him versus just breaking even. Okay, onto another priest. Priest of Titania. 1 and a green for a 1-1 elf. Tap, add green equal to the number of elves in play on the battlefield. By the way, not just your elves, all elves. This was, for a long time, in fact, I'm sure this is still played in Legacy, the elf deck. This is a major, major player in the elf deck. This is the thing that allows elf decks to just sort of, you know, turn to 11, if you will, that just allows you to sort of ramp up to huge amounts of mana. It's funny, because Gaea's Cradle gets you a green mana for every creature you have in play. And Priest of Titania, when you are playing an elf deck, so let's assume your opponent has no elves, just you have an elf deck and all your creatures are elves, essentially is that. The only difference is, Gaea's Cradle is a legendary land, you can have one. The Priest of Titania is not legendary, you can have 4 of them. So this thing really can produce a lot of mana. And like I said, it was very powerful. Next, Raze. Okay, so Raze was a sorcery. What it did is, as an additional cost to pay it, you had to destroy a land. Or when you cast it, when you cast it, sack a land, and then destroy target land. So essentially for 1 mana, it's like, I destroy one of your lands of my choice, and I destroy one of my lands of my choice. So each of us are losing a land, but I choose what those lands are. And Raze was so good, if you look at the 1999 World Championship, the finals was Kai Buda versus Mark Lapine. And Mark Lapine was playing a really aggressive land destruction deck. And Raze was part of that. During this time period, we just gave you, we gave you enough land destruction things in red that you really could do something pretty destructive. And the fact that this costs 1 mana. Yes, it costs your land, but if your deck is about just getting rid of lands, like if your opponent isn't doing something, you got time to build up. Like, you're eventually going to get ahead of them. If you're destroying their lands and they're not destroying yours, fine. You'll trade 1 for 1 from times just to keep them from developing at all. So anyway, I made Raze as one of the cards after the fact, like, what did I do? That was a big mistake. But anyway, it was very powerful. Okay, Remote Isle is a land. Enters the battlefield, tap. You can tap to add blue, and it cycles for 2. So this is one of the 5 cycling lands. There's also the colorless one. These are all enter the battlefield tap. So there's 5, 1 of each color. we made these just because we thought that cycling would go really well on land. Everything was cycling too. When we bring these back in Onslaught, we actually upgrade them and make it, instead of costing two, costing C, which makes them better, obviously. These still got played, especially in... there were cycling decks and stuff. Got played in cycling decks. And even... it still was useful from time to time if you had a slower deck. If the fact that your lands came in tapped didn't matter as much to you because you're playing more a control-ish deck, sometimes the ability to trade later lands into cards was really valuable. Okay, Rescind. Rescind is an instant. Costs two blue, so four mana, two which is blue. Counter target spell, and then untap up to four lands. So this is the free spell counter spell. Now, here's something interesting about this. We've repeated this in the basic set. We've not done that with very many free mechanic spells. And the reason that this is allowable is, what we learned is, being reactionary matters a lot. That when I can use my free mechanic to help generate mana for me, it's problematic. But when I don't control when I use it, you know, when it's like on my opponent's turn and reaction to their spells, when it's not a good window for me to be untapping my stuff, it's nowhere near as powerful. So we were able to actually reprint this card because reactive free spells aren't nearly as problematic. Like, there's a lot of other free mechanic cards we would never reprint, especially in a core set. But Rescind was, I believe, in multiple core sets. So it does say that sometimes when you have something that's broken, it doesn't mean every aspect of it's broken. You know, you have to understand how and why it's broken. Okay, let's see how many... okay, so... I don't think I'm going to finish today, but I'm gonna make a noble attempt here. Okay, next, Seasoned Marshal. Hold on one second. Something in the middle of the road I didn't want to hit. Okay, Seasoned Marshal. It is two white for a 2/2 human soldier. When it attacks, you tap target creature. This is something we do all the time right now, but it is something that we didn't do... we didn't do a lot when we made this. This might be the first time we did this ability. Like, one of the interesting things about going back and looking at old Magic sets is, I told this story about how, like, I studied film in school. So we'd watch film classes. You'd watch a film and you're like, yeah, whatever. And you're like, no. Like, we watched, like, what I was talking about, The Great Train Robbery, which looks... When you first see it, it looks almost amateurish. You know what I'm saying? It looks like some kids made it. And they're like, no. This is early film. See here where they're at one place, and they cut, and they're at another place, and they cut back into the first place, and it conveys that the events of those two places are going on simultaneously. Yeah, that didn't happen. This is where they created that. This is where they came up with that language in film. You know, and the point is, it's such a thing that's just an everyday place that you're so used to that it doesn't even think like it. But like, somebody had to go, that had to not exist, and somebody had to make it exist. So Seasoned Marshal is good. I think this is the first card that ever did this. Like, this is now just a staple thing white does. But like, at some point, someone had to go, hey, here's a neat idea for white. So like, one of the cool things about that is, I mean, this is just a really good example of how one of the neat things about going back and looking at old cards, look at the history, like. I talk a lot about how this is a history of magic podcast at times. It's also a history of magic design podcast that we've learned a lot over the years. And one of the things I love is going back and looking at sets and saying, oh, this is where we came up with that. Like, I'm pretty sure Seasoned Marshal is the first time we did this. That's where we're like, okay, you know, they tap trigger to tap something. Like, white can tap things, and we had tappers before this. You know, Master Decoy goes back to Mirage, I believe. So white could tap things. But just the idea of saying, oh, well, what if we made an attack trigger a tap? You know, the timing's perfect. It's newer order friendly. It, you know, reduces the amount of choices the opponent had to make. It's just done at the right time where it's thematic, it's flavorful. It's just neat seeing that happen and going, oh, that's where we figured out to do that. You know, that is pretty cool. So I definitely like, I don't know. I like when we go back and look at things. And, I mean, the designer in me definitely is always excited. So I realized I forgot a card I meant to talk about, so I'm going to go back. Back to P. I forgot to talk about Phyrexian Tower. So this is a land. You tap to add a colorless mana, or tap sack a creature, add black. So the interesting thing about this card was we made a cycle of lands. So the white land is Sarah Sanctum, the blue land is Salarian Academy, the black land was Phyrexian Tower, The red land was it Shivan Gorge? And the green land was Gaea's Cradle. Shivan Gorge, right? Yeah, Shivan Gorge is correct. I'm about to talk to that soon, maybe. Maybe this podcast, maybe next podcast. So anyway, people, because the white, blue, and green ones work very similarly, tap add seed to your mana pool, I mean, add a certain color to your mana pool equal to some permanent play. You know, add white equal to enchantments, blue equal to artifacts, green equal to creatures that you control. That the black and red didn't feel like they fit part of that cycle, but you know, we did have a legendary land with that had black in it and one that had red in it, and so they were tied to colors. But it's one of those things where we tied some of them so closely that the others didn't feel connected. The interesting thing is that Phyrexian Tower actually ended up being a playable deck. One of the major reasons is something I did in Urza's Destiny. I made a theme in Urza's Destiny of being leaves play triggers, things that when they died, actually I guess they were death triggers, when they put in the battlefield from play triggers. And so having I made some very powerful ones. A powerful one probably was Academy Rector, which when it died, it got to go through your library, find an enchantment, and put it into play. In fact, I also had one that did with creatures. Anyway, I made some powerful, and Urza's Destiny. We'll get to Urza's Destiny. We'll talk all about this. But I also had a card that was sort of a new necropotence called Yawgmoth's Bargain. And so you needed a way to sacrifice your Rector to go get your bargain. And so it turns out Phyrexian Tower was very efficient. It lets you sacrifice creatures, lets you get mana. So it happened to fit the metagame really well. So Phyrexian Tower was, even though people complain about it not being up to snuff with some of the other lands in the cycle, it was still very good. It still saw play. It was still a powerful card. So, I don't know. I feel like Phyrexian Tower was not. Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem also was there aren't five permanent, or at least at the time, there weren't five permanent types. So as far as, you know, there is land, which tapping equal to land is a little crazy, and planeswalkers didn't exist. And that's the five permanent types, so it wasn't even a cycle we could completely finish that way. Okay, next, Sarah Avatar. This is another cool card. So four white for a star avatar, and its power and toughness were equal to your life total. And then it said if Sarah Avatar goes to the graveyard from anywhere, shuffled into your library. That last ability was just, this was such a good reanimation target that we didn't want you to be able to reanimate it. You know, for example, it costs you 7 mana, 3 of which is white. So if you pay 7 mana, you get something pretty potent. And, you know, something each of your life can be pretty potent. It's 7 mana, so later in the game, usually it's not a 20/20 by the time you get to 7 mana. But if you can reanimate it, especially back in the day when we had really cheap reanimation, you know, we had reanimation for 1 and 2 mana. We didn't want you, like, you know, somehow dumping this into your graveyard and then on turn 1 or 2 or 3 or something, you know, getting a 20/20. That was pretty potent. So that's why the writer's in there. This was a really popular card. The funny thing about this card is it seems a little more powerful than it is. If you actually have to cast it for 7 mana, 3 which is white, it's a little bit harder to use. The other thing that's cool about this card is white is the life gaining color, so not only can you play it, but when you play in white, you can play it with life gain, and so that makes it better. The problem at the time was life gain sucked. So this became a very fun casual deck, which is, I have a lot of life gain in a Sarah Avatar. So it's like, you're having trouble dealing with me because I keep gaining life. I'm being very defensive. And then, the thing that I'm going to kill you with is this giant creature that often was bigger than 20/20. If I can get my life total higher than 20/20, because I'm doing a lot of life gain. I don't think this card was ever, I mean, I might be wrong. I don't remember this being a big card in any sort of tournament setting. But it was much beloved. It was a very casual, friendly card. Okay, my final one today is Sarah Sanctum. So this was the land where it's a legendary land. Tap to add a white mana for every enchantment you have on the battlefield. Funny thing is, this card had to live in the shadows of Tolarian Academy and Gaea's Cradle. And the answer is, when you compare it to Tolarian Academy, this card is way worse. You know, Tolarian Academy gets to do artifacts. There are zero-drop artifacts. You can actually, on the turn one, drop a number of zero-cost artifacts, and Tolarian Academy, on turn one, is tapping for a huge amount of mana. Enchantments aren't that way. The enchantments have mana costs, and, you know, there aren't a lot of even cheap enchantments that are really tournament-level cards. You compare Serra's Sanctum even to Gaea's Cradle, it's kind of weak, because... you know, there's just a lot of cheaper creatures, and there's creatures that produce mana. You know, there's things that are... Magic makes one-drop creatures, like, we want you to have a curve. So there are just good, efficient, one-drop, tournament-quality creatures that we make. So Tolarian Academy was, like, crazy, crazy good, and Gaea's Cradle was really good. So a lot of times people think of Serra's Sanctum as being weak. Not weak. Really strong card. Very powerful card. It's only in... I mean, if we had made this card in a vacuum and Tolarian Academy and Gaea's Cradle didn't exist, it would be a powerhouse. It is just, you know, it's like, it's just the weakest, it's like, you know, it's part of the triplets, and the two other triplets are just bigger. But this is a big triplet. This is a powerful one. You know, this was a really powerful card, and it did see play, and there are people that were using it, and there were cool things you could do with it. I know there were enchantment transist decks and things that were enchantment-centered already that really use this to good effect. But anyway, do not dismiss the Serra's Sanctum. It's actually a pretty powerful card. Serra's Sanctum, by the way, was, in the story, it was the realm that Serra had designed. And so anyway, it represented that. It was actually not on Dominaria. But anyway, I'm here at my daughter's school, and that means that it's the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll talk to you guys next time. Bye-bye.